From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Kurdish fighters in Syria have been on the forefront of helping to defeat the Islamic State, or ISIS. Kurds are spread throughout multiple nations, including Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq, and have been both victimized by governments and played a leading role in international conflicts. Within Kurdish Syria is an autonomous Kurdish-run enclave named Rojava that has democratic principles and women's rights at the forefront of its organizing. Today, we'll turn to a leading Kurdish activist who has written extensively about Rojava and has translated the words of the Kurdish nationalist leader Abdullah Öcalan. Haven Gunesar is a Kurdish writer, journalist, and women's rights activist. She's a spokesperson for the International Initiative Freedom for Abdullah Öcalan Peace in Kurdistan. She's an engineer and a journalist, and she writes and speaks extensively on the topic of revolution in Rojava.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Can you tell me first about the International Kurdish Freedom Movement? You've been a lifelong activist with this movement. What is this organization and what does it span geographically? Is it a global organization?
Mm-hmm. I mean, at the moment, I'm the spokesperson for the International Initiative Freedom for Abdullah Öcalan and Peace in Kurdistan. As you may know, Abdullah Öcalan is the leader of most of the Kurdish people, and he was abducted in an international NATO operation and abducted in Kenya and handed over to Turkey. So he's been on an island prison for more than 10 years alone, and now with three other people. So in general, though, Kurdish freedom movement spans across not only the homeland of the Kurds, which is divided between Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, but also as a result of the repression at home of Kurdish people finding refuge in other places around the world. So therefore, it spans a huge geography all over the world where Kurds and their friends are basically living. And, you know, it has meant so much more than to be a struggle about the bare identity of the Kurds, which is, of course, indeed still under grave danger of genocides and massacres, you know, from almost all four states in the Middle East at the moment. But it has also meant a huge quest for freedom, that of women, but also in general, about the meaning of life and how to go about strengthening and finding ways to an alternative life.
Where is where would you say currently is the greatest sort of flashpoint for the Kurdish struggle today? I mean, years ago, Iraq was a very, very important issue. Today, Syria, is Syria the place where you feel the struggle for of Kurdish people is perhaps the most prominent?
Mm-hmm. I mean, just like everywhere else, there are different struggles based on different ideological lines. The one that has been waged in north of Iraq, or what we call South Kurdistan, is basically one not based on the more alternative concepts of freedom and women's freedom, but it is more of a statist ideological line. And but the ones that have been waged under the general umbrella of the Kurdish freedom movement has been the ones based more a non-state struggle that is based on the on a democratic women's freedom and ecological ideology and paradigm. So therefore, the struggle, especially in what we call North Kurdistan, which is the Turkish Kurdistan, as well as what's going on in Northern Syrian Federation, which is Rojava at the same time, is of very much of an importance. However, I think as much as this is important, what we're seeing is that what will be really decisive is what will happen in Iranian Kurdistan and also in Kurdistan in Turkey.
Why is that? What is the situation in Iranian Kurdistan today? I mean, does it have much to do with outside players such as the United States and its interest in Iran?
Of course, these are of importance, but I think the real importance is due to the fact that the Ottoman Empire, what was before Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, and the various Persian empires come from pretty deep roots and have traditional policies. So therefore, they are actually setting the mark in what is happening in the Middle East at the moment, especially in relation to the Kurdish question as well. We're seeing that in Syria at the moment, those who are also stopping the development of a more democratic society in Syria is foremost Turkey as well as Iran. Almost they are like an obstacle in front of finding a more an acceptable solution to the problems that are experienced in Syria. Therefore, what's happening in Syria is a battleground for both local and global hegemonic powers.
And of course, in that terrible conflict, you have not just the Syrian government, you have Russia and Iran, and then you have the US in the mix. You've got Turkey, of course. The Kurdish fighters in Syria have played a very critical role, haven't they, in the fight against the Islamic State? But I think, as you just alluded, some of those democratic ideals, some of those principles based on women's rights are still anathema for the governments that, you know, claim to support democracy in theory.
Well, yes, what is happening over there, of course, is what we say, what we call a third world war, you know, which means that, you know, capitalist modernity is in a dire structural crisis. And what kind of a new system will replace it totally depends on the struggles that are waged at the moment. It doesn't necessarily mean that a more democratic order will reign over the world, especially if the hegemonic powers can help it, you know. So what we're seeing actually is that, you know, on the one hand, the global capital, especially represented by the United States of America, is trying very hard to actually disacknowledge all the different agreements and institutions of both the First World War and the Second World War. And but we should not just see this as an imperialist project. At the same time, what we're seeing is that the struggles of different peoples like the Kurds or women all over the world, or workers and others, have actually also contributed from the grassroots to this structural crisis, and especially the shattering, or you know, the situation with the nation states are in. Therefore, I think Syria is such a perfect example of that. On the one hand, there are the status quo, the powers who are trying to uphold the status quo. You know, Russia is one. It also has regional and world hegemonic dreams. Iran is one. It has hegemonic dreams not only in the Middle East, but you know, we saw it in different parts of the world as well. And the same with Turkey, especially recently, the neo-Ottoman, you know, veins began, you know, reinvigorating. And so we have both the state, or those who protect who wants the institutionalization or the continuation of the status quo, with actually, if they can, a little bit more land grabbing here and there, but also, you know, hegemonic world powers who are trying to battle it out in the Middle East to see who will be the next power to lead the world. So therefore, what the Kurds are doing is neither, because their situation is the result of the old world order, and the new world order will not accept them either because of what they stand for.
So let's discuss what it is that they stand for. You have these various states in which Kurds are struggling in the Iraq, Iran, Syria, Turkey. Within those states, what is the social order? What is the economic order that Kurds have been coalescing around? And how does it pose a threat to the capitalist worldview? What are some of the internal mechanisms that really ought to be studied, I think, by people around the world?
Sure. Well, first of all, it is putting itself in tandem with all the struggles that have been waged before or at present. So it considers itself part of those struggles for freedom and also, you know, ecological economy and democracy, radical democracy.
And when you say ecological economy, what does that mean?
Okay, that means that producing not for profits, you know, but for communal needs and personal needs, and of course based on sharing and solidarity. And it also means that there is no room for monopolization of any kind, whether it's about economic means of production or, you know, in terms of ideological tools or education or media or et cetera. So what we are looking at, I mean, it is not just looked through solely economics, because the reason for that is economics actually sits on a wider oppression and exploitation, you know, that is not just, you know, it's about women's colonization at the same time. It's about youth suppression at the same time. So it looks at, you know, both the different ways of how this economic exploitation is and colonization is possible. And it sees that, you know, it's also through the use of violence. It's also through the use of making this legitimized through the production of knowledge, not just through the production of products, you know, and having control over the means of production. So therefore, it intertwines all these different, it deconstructs how this colonization process over the surplus product has taken place, and it tries to deconstruct and makes mechanisms, you know, that can be precautionary so that this does not repeat itself, but at the same time allows for the society to freely become refunctional again.
Is it this autonomy and this independence that the various state governments see as dangerous and a threat?
I mean, sure. I mean, have a look at it, you know. Like what is being happening is that, you know, there's a reinvigoration of nationalism, sexism, and et cetera. And what we are seeing in the midst of a place where nobody thought it could happen, that it is a completely, you know, it defends a complete coexistence with multiple pluralities, you know, and it's not going nationalist. Instead, it is saying, okay, you know, we can live with Arabs, Turks, Assyrians, Armenians, you know, because we've lived on this land for thousands and thousands of years. You know, when you look at the history of capitalist modernity, it's only about 500 years. And when we look at the wider, and I'm not saying before 500 years, things were all great, but at least it wasn't based on a dominant nationhood, you know, which is constructed in such a way that the wars can be waged upon. And in doing this, of course, you know, the world is turning into a huge graveyard of beautiful cultures, languages, and of women, of course.
Haven, what is your position on the referendum for an independent Kurdistan, and do those efforts are they consistent with or not with the work that you're doing?
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, this is some of the political parties in South Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan, brought in. And, you know, it wasn't something that was really discussed with even the community in South Kurdistan. You have to see, you know, why all of a sudden this idea was brought in, the role that these different ideological parties are trying to play. I mean, when we look at South Kurdistan, unfortunately, what we are seeing is a disillusionment of, you know, the hopes of the people there. Because now, you know, that part of Kurdistan is being turned into an almost province of partly Turkey and partly Iran, you know. And we're not even seeing any proper formation of, you know, even the bare minimum of, even if you want to do a nation building. So it's a very I have to say, a corrupt powers who are at play there, and they are actually trying to turn the tables around in benefiting only a certain, you know, class of elite rulers in South Kurdistan as well. And this is why, you know, the Greater Kurdish Freedom Movement is making such a huge critique of the state tool, you know. And
it reminds me of,
and concluding that, you know, just because you were the victim of other state does not mean that you can't become a perpetrator, you know. And we are seeing that happening in South Kurdistan. There's a huge clampdown on people and on their, you know, ability to democratically develop themselves so that the lid can be kept on, you know. And this is not only not playing a very positive role for the Kurds in general, because these political parties played a very negative role for Rojava as well, you know, in trying to shut the borders, you know, make sure the revolution doesn't survive, because they saw that as a threat to their own ruling in South Kurdistan. And it is also not a very good way of doing things for the people of the region in general, because it kind of, you know, tries to deepen the animosities and the nationalism that is actually going on.
Oh, finally, Haven, tell me, let's also focus a little bit on the unique role that women and women's rights have played in Rojava. You referred to it briefly a few times, but what are some of why are women's rights so critical to social justice, to democracy, to this sort of unique setup in Rojava that has set this particular formation apart?
Mm-hmm. I think it's just really more than women's rights. Mm-hmm. It's more radical than that, because when we talk of women's rights, we're kind of, you know, talking a little bit more of mending the situation that is at play. And I think this is where the radicalness of the idea of democratic confederalism really comes from. And this is how and why there was a huge rupture from the state, from the idea of state, you know, as an empowering tool for peoples who have been colonized, you know. And so the idea of the woman's freedom, I think, is so powerful because it sets the scene not only to show that this is how women's enslavement worked, but this is how patriarchy became institutionalized. And this is how, in fact, all other enslavements, actually including that of men, although they have, of course, you know, been given women to them so they can be part and parcel at large of this patriarchy, because when we look at it, you know, capitalism is only a system of a very, you know, top percentage as well. And we are seeing that everybody else is also somehow colonized and oppressed and exploited. So, but woman is what is given to the male so that the system can regenerate and perpetuate itself. So therefore, when we talk of women's freedom, we are actually always linking it with liberation of life and freedom of life, and therefore freedom of men as well, and also that of, you know, a more sound and healthy development of the society in general. So it has amazing overarching, you know, tones to it. And this is why, you know, you see this this amazing revolution where it is not expected at all, you know, in the midst of, you know, the efforts to create the most, you know, fascist form of male institution, like it was in the form of ISIS. But we are seeing this actually occurring all over the world, you know. I mean, ISIS was the most extreme form of fascism, of institutionalized male formation. But, you know, if you look at Trump, it's it's in a different end and extreme. It's also this tradition it's trying to bring about is also based on huge sexism, nationalism, you know, and et cetera. So, or Erdogan, for example, it is also calling out on the male again all over the world to empower patriarchy. And, you know, they all almost want to use the male again as a paramilitary force all over the world to take back all the accumulation of the working class peoples, women, and etc. So this is why it's such a radical concept, you know, both for women's freedom, but also in changing the world system, which we have a window actually to do at the moment.
I certainly think there's an analogy to be made between some of the reactionary and backward views that we see of the fundamentalist forces in the Middle East and those here in the United States that are very much linked to Trump. That reactionary sort of misogyny, unfortunately, is an international phenomenon. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Haven. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Haven Güneser. She is a Kurdish writer, journalist, and women's rights activist, and a spokesperson for the International Initiative Freedom for Abdullah Öcalan, Peace in Kurdistan. She is an engineer, a journalist, and a women's rights activist who writes and speaks extensively on the topic of revolution in Rojava. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.